Hi, I'm Steve Clemens, and I have a question. Are China and the U.S. sleepwalking their way to war? Let's get to the bottom line. It's obvious that we're already in the middle of Cold War 2.0, with Russia and China on one side and the West on the other. This is happening in real time, folks. Russia is openly challenging NATO with its incursion into and threats against a sovereign and independent neighbor, Ukraine. But let's take a step back for a moment. Russia needed to cover its flank with China to do what it's doing. And Russia's economy is Lilliputian compared to China, whose GDP is 15 times bigger than Russia's. Within just a few years, China will be the world's number one economy, and its influence is spreading worldwide, mostly at the expense of American global leadership. President Joe Biden is desperately trying to beef up alliances in Asia and retain an American-led world order. But is it working? And is there a way to keep U.S.-China competition from heating up into outright war down the road? My guest today says there is a way. He is Kevin Rudd, the former Prime Minister of Australia and current president of the Asia Society in New York. His book is coming out next month, and it's called The Avoidable War, The Dangers of a Catastrophic Conflict Between the United States and Xi Jinping's China. Former Prime Minister Rudd, Kevin, it's great to see you. Let me just ask you, you set up a stark question. As we look back in history, and we've seen the history of rising powers and falling powers, deflating powers, very frequently there is a defining conflict between them. And you believe that that kind of war is avoidable between China and the United States. Can you share with us your thoughts?
Well, thank you, Steve. Yeah, my friend and colleague from Harvard University, Graham Allison, put out a landmark study in around about 2016 entitled Destined for War. It was an application of what he called Thucydides' trap, which deals with the history of rising powers and established powers and the tipping point in their relationship when one preempts or one engages in a preemptive attack against the other. Graham's study looked at some 16 case studies in history, found that those that he looked at, 12 of the 16 resulted in war and four did not. So the answer to your question is, history tells us there's a large predisposition for this sort of strategic competition to end up in armed conflict. But history also tells us that there are exceptions. But in order to make the exceptions work, you need a strategic mechanism, a strategic framework in order to prevent that outcome. And that's why in the book and the work I've done over recent years through the Asia Society, I advocate a doctrine of what's called managed strategic competition. It's not kumbaya handholding, far from it. It's realist in its nature, but it also goes to the machinery that's necessary to allow strategic competition to occur, but not with ultimate recourse to blowing each other's brains out.
Well, Kevin, you're one of the few people that I know who knows all the parties involved. You speak Mandarin. You've spent a lot of time in Asia. You were a head of government in Australia dealing both with the United States and China. And I purposely wanted to have this conversation with you today while we had growing tensions in the Ukraine-Russia situation and looking at the solvency of America's support of European security on whether or not this situation where Russia's moving in one direction becomes a distraction from the priority of also trying to figure out how you manage strategically competition with China. How do you see America dealing with two different challenges at the same time? Well, right now, Russia and China have the rosiest relationship they've had in decades.
Well, the bottom line is the United States now in 2022 is in an infinitely better shape than it was in 2020. And there are a number of reasons for that. This administration speaks with a single voice as opposed to the divided voices we heard during the Trump administration, some advocating appeasement of China, others advocating active deterrence, and some advocating open confrontation. There is a single voice from this administration. Secondly, you touched on this, Steve. President Biden has spent a lot of time rebuilding bridges to allies both in Asia and in Europe, and also to some extent in the Middle East. Therefore, that repair work is well and truly underway. And thirdly, the Biden administration has brought about a new piece of strategic architecture. It's called the Quad, linking Japan, India, Australia and the United States. So these represent significant, shall I say, improvements on America's net position relative to where we were just a couple of years ago. But in terms of the geopolitics of Russia and Ukraine, you know, the Chinese always look at this in terms of net balance of power equations. And what they do see with their emerging strategic alliance with the Russian Federation is a net positive for themselves relative to the balance of power with the United States, most particularly in terms of Russia's ability to create headaches for America in the European theater and in the Middle Eastern and North African theater. But the challenge for America is, as you pointed to in your question, can America work in terms of two major theater preoccupations at once? Well, traditional American strategic doctrine has always rested on the proposition that America could fight two major wars simultaneously. Now, the United States Armed Forces capabilities remain robust. The question of the United States, of course, underneath it all, is the extent to which the Congress and national political sentiment remains equally robust. And that, I think, is an open question.
There was a time where I think America was an undisputed economic hegemon in Asia. I don't think that is the case anymore. But I think your book also begins to explore what defines power in the world. Is it your Navy? Is it your missiles? Is it your military clout? Or is it the ability to have soft power and have, you know, Dunkin' Donuts and Kentucky Fried Chicken abroad? Is it economic weight? How do you deal with that tension between economic power, which China clearly is today, versus conventional military power?
Well, the Chinese have a very interesting concept for this, Steve. It's called comprehensive national power, or CNP. The Chinese word for it is four characters, Zhonghe Guoli. And it seeks to aggregate all the elements of power, from military power to economic power, technological power, the resilience of your populations, political will, ability to work with friends and partners around the world, etc. The Chinese believe, based on their own calculation, that this aggregate balance of power, not just militarily, is moving in China's direction, hence why they use the phrase the rise of the East and the decline of the West. However, what are the problems in China's power equation? One is, we've always assumed that the Chinese economy is going to grow like this into the long-term future. Well, there are signs of some level of faltering growth within China induced by some domestic policy missteps. And furthermore, we still don't know the shape the Chinese economy will have coming out of its isolation from the pandemic. But also, there is a second problem for the longer-term future as well, and that is China still remains significantly behind the United States in key categories of technology, most particularly in microchips, semiconductors, where the United States and its partners and allies in South Korea and in Taiwan still have a significant advantage. So therefore, the Chinese are not about to move anytime soon, for example, in relation to Taiwan, because they do see and recognize that while the trend is with them, there are still many holes in their sails.
You know, if you were president of the United States or advising President Biden, what would be some of the things you would do? You talked about AI, you talked about technology in a moment ago. Should we be doing more on that front as opposed to looking at, you know, military confrontation in the region?
Well, the truth is, Steve, if you're president of the United States, you've seriously got to walk and chew gum at the same time. That is, make sure your domestic house is in order, the strength of the American economy, the power of its technology, the resilience of its body politic, while at the same time attending to long-term external strategy and the international balance of power. You don't get to choose which of those you're going to attend to. But I think the second thing is this. There is a lot of negative talk about America's ability to, frankly, reconstitute its economy after some of the battering that's occurred through the pandemic. What I've seen through post-war economic history is a long history of America's capacity to rebuild itself. Yes, there's a current macroeconomic problem, which is inflation. But the key challenge is to ensure that the drivers of America's technology advantage continue, that its manufacturing remains robust, and that its R&D effort out there, research and development effort, remains at the forefront of the world, and you continue to attract the best and brightest from around the world as well, rather than closing the door. China, remember, is ultimately a closed society. There is no net migration to China. Secondly, as I said, there are constraints in terms of its domestic economic model, which I think has changed under Xi Jinping to the rip-roaring neo-capitalist ways of Deng Xiaoping and his immediate successors. And that, in part, is slowing growth. And as I said, therefore, it's not just plain sailing, that is, China's rise and America's decline. This is a much more complex picture. And I think the Chinese, the more prudent among them, will be highly cautious in the way in which they deal with the American juggernaut in the future. So I don't think we should sell America short just yet.
I think of all world leaders I've had the privilege to get to know, you understand the mindset of Chinese leaders better than anyone I know. And I'm wondering to what degree they worry that they get out of step with their own public. I was on Alibaba's website the other day, a kind of mall, where I saw Chinese buying Allbirds shoes from America, Fender guitars. You saw virtual setups of IKEA stores that were 3D. You had influence basically selling Western products. This is something that didn't exist when we were having trade disputes with Japan. And I saw that, and I just went, said, wow, I learned from you, Xi Jinping's daughter went to Harvard. So there's lots of connectivity to the West. Do you think that Chinese leaders, Xi Jinping and others, worry that that appetite for Western stuff is going to become politically important inside China?
Well, you're right to point to that, Steve. Way back in 2013, just after Xi Jinping took over, he delivered a speech to the central ideological and propaganda apparatus of the party. Not a gathering of funsters, by the way. This is serious, earnest political stuff. But subsequently, and almost uniquely in modern Chinese politics, the full text of his unscripted remarks was released. There we saw Xi Jinping unvarnished. And the attitude which Xi Jinping had to the threat of the West's cultural influence within China, to use or to paraphrase his own language, sapping away the strength of the vital nutrients of a Communist Party classical Chinese civilization, revealed, in my view, a very, very deep concern. Secondly, it's one of the reasons why he and Vladimir Putin get on so well. When they get together, they often spend their time talking about the threat of democratic color revolutions, which, of course, Steve, in your journalistic career, you would have covered many times before, not least in the Ukraine. And so, therefore, there is a deep concern about the power and the pull of Western and, more specifically, American cultural models. At the same time, his antidote to that is to run a campaign based on highly defined Chinese nationalism, sports nationalism of the type we've just seen in the Winter Olympics in Beijing itself, other forms of nationalism as well, often a binary nationalism about what they say domestically is America's efforts to keep China down, often inferring it's for racial reasons rather than ideological reasons or any other reasons or any causalities related to China itself. So there is, to answer your question, a deep concern. And my final point on this would be as follows. Xi Jinping is different to his post-Mao political predecessors, Deng Xiaoping, Jiang Zemin, Hu Jintao, quite different. And he is trying to accelerate the pace of China's rise and accelerate the pace of the party's preeminence within China's economy and society and politics. But you know something? Even in an authoritarian country, you can force the pace too much. You can engage in overreach. And there is some reaction in China to an overreach in domestic political control, an overreach in terms of the new constraints around the Chinese private sector, and perhaps an overreach in terms of tacit support of Russia's efforts most recently in the Ukraine.
Kevin, is there a way for America to remain consequential, even pivotal in the region, in the Indo-Pacific region, without returning to something like a Trans-Pacific Partnership. You talked about the Quad, so the new efforts to sort of align with India, with Australia, with Japan. I think a silent member of that is probably South Korea. But when you're in that and you don't have a Trans-Pacific Partnership, if you don't have a kind of region embracing trade deal, can America ever really be powerful and influential with its neighbors in the Asia-Pacific, Indo-Pacific region?
Well, Steve, your question's a fundamentally important one because it goes to the fundamental elements of China's medium to long-term strategy. And it's called this, it's the economy, stupid. And the more China's economy grows in relation to that of the United States, the more China becomes the principal market, export market for countries around Asia, but frankly, around the world. And the more China becomes the source of foreign direct investment and capital flows over time, the less relevant the United States becomes in economic aggregate. Xi Jinping has a really interesting phrase on this, Steve. He refers to, quote, China exploiting the gravitational pull of the Chinese economy on the rest of the world, unquote. And so therefore, going back to something you said earlier in our discussion today, it's causing people to act early as they conclude that over the longer term, the Chinese economic juggernaut is unstoppable. So what do you do about that if you're the United States? Well, if you assume that in the Congress, the America's congressmen, and I'm about to say something unfortunate here, are too dumb to recognize that America's strength in the past around the world has been driven by free trade and open investment flows. And if the political resistance to, therefore, a reopening of the Trans-Pacific Partnership is too great because of that collective dumbness, then there are different ways in which you can crack these eggs. For example, you've touched on one. Can you turn the Quad into the beginnings of a new form of open trade architecture in the wider Indo-Pacific? Remember, India at present has historically been quite protectionist. Can the current geostrategic circumstances, which brings India in the Quad, cause India to be induced, together with Japan and the United States, to begin forging a new set of open economic arrangements with each other, perhaps also drawing the Europeans as well? That, therefore, could become, in aggregate, something bigger than the TPP and bigger than what's called TTIP, the Atlantic equivalent of the TPP, an open set of economic arrangements between the United States and Europe.
Well, and you're at the Asia Society, which for our viewers is one of the really great institutions. It's based in New York, but it's really a global institution with resources and connections all over. So I just ask you, from your gut feeling, do you see anything along those lines developing, regarding trade, regarding an economic awareness, regarding, you know, some big approach? When you look at China's contributions to the global middle class, taking people out of poverty, but, you know, looking at where the global middle class is growing and rising, a lot of it is in Asia and Southeast Asia, big portion of that. And so it raises the question, if we were to decouple with China, we were to have a splinter net and change the way we deal with each other technologically and creating standards, one wonders how much of the global middle class will be under their tent, how much of it will be in our tent. And I think you're right that it's going to require some big response. But my question to you is, do you see any green shoots in that?
What I do know the administration's thinking in Washington is that they fully understand that the fundamental nature of the competitive relationship between the United States and China long term, and all the geopolitics which flows from that, lies essentially in geoeconomics and lies in the relative strength, power, and pull of their two economies, their two trading systems, their two investment networks, their two sets of emerging and competitive capital markets, and their hold on future technology. The United States now fully gets that. However, on the question of what do you do about it, what China and Russia are banking on, actually, is that those idiots in the Congress will, to use a phrase, cut off their nose to spite their face. That is, believe that for local protectionist impulses, particularly induced during the Trump period, that the smart thing to do is to continue to shut the American economy down to external competition or, frankly, acts of external openness to global markets, because that serves your ability to get yourself re-elected in 2 years' time as a member of Congress, as opposed to taking a strategic view, which is throwing open the doors of the American market once again to open trade and investment and technology flows and and America once again becoming the destination point for millions of migrants each year. Therein lies the strength of America's future economy if they can bite the political bullet. On the specific Quad-related arrangements that I spoke about before, what I find fascinating is that there are emerging, intelligent, sophisticated conversations that are beginning to come out of parts of Washington right. on how to evolve the Quad, including economically, into the future.
Just finally, Kevin, I think one of the ways the Thucydides trap is avoided, the worst outcome, if for those of you who follow game theory, is avoided, is by having very wide-eyed, open understanding of what the worst case could be and look like. And I wonder if in a minute or so you could help describe to our audience what a war with China would look like. What would it mean to the world?
It would be mutually catastrophic in its consequences. The Chinese Communist Party leadership, if war broke out and if it was doing badly, for example, with the United States, in order to ensure its own survival, would escalate. I do not believe we can therefore comfortably assume it would remain a conventional war. Secondly, in the Taiwan Straits, this is not likely simply to remain some sort of limited engagement between a breakaway province and the PRC. The reverse is, in fact, for the PRC to prevail, they plan and would plan to preemptively take out American military facilities, for example, in Guam and in Okinawa, and perhaps even in Yokohama. And so, therefore, the idea that this is potentially some limited engagement is just dead wrong. And that's before you get to the cyber dimensions. Therefore, managed strategic competition of the type I describe as a potential joint strategic narrative for both countries, with areas of clear strategic red lines mutually recognized, areas of continued and open strategic competition continuing, but still an avenue for areas of strategic collaboration in areas like climate change, I think is the most sensible pathway to the future.
Well, thank you so much for conceptualizing for that and sharing with us your views. We can't wait for your book to come out. Kevin Rudd, former Prime Minister of Australia, current President and CEO of the Asia Society, and author of The Avoidable War, The Dangers of a Catastrophic Conflict Between the U.S. and Xi Jinping's China. Thanks so much for joining us, Kevin.
Happy to be with you, Steve.
So what's the bottom line? There are very few times in the history of nations when two powers, a great power fading and another new power rising, don't come to blows. Yes, I'm talking about war. My guest is completely right that the cultural, political, and historic dimensions of China are understood by very few Western politicians. And that means the chances for misunderstanding or miscommunication are really great. Like former Prime Minister Rudd said, this is a decisive decade. Either China and the U.S. set themselves up for a smooth relationship, some kind of understanding or accommodation or arrangement, or else this is going to come down to a potentially really nasty confrontation. 20 years ago, Americans were happy to be importing everything from shoes to car parts from China, and no one imagined that we'd be talking about Beijing displacing America's global power. There was no talk of a Cold War, but here we are now in the middle of it. It's time to think about the real consequences of this growing divide. And that's the bottom line.